Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jim Husson. I'm Boston College's Senior Vice President for University Advancement. It's a pleasure to welcome you here to today's Beacon Leadership Conversation. We're going to be joined shortly by Joy Moore, Vice President for Student Affairs, and a little later on by Craig Burns, our Director of University Counseling Services. Let me just share a couple of housekeeping notes for those of you who are joining us for the first time. We'll run our session for an hour ending at 1 o'clock. And during that time, I'm going to pose questions to Joy and then later to Craig. And we're gonna get into a conversation, which is really what this is intended to be, a dialogue that hopefully will bring out issues that we know are on the minds of our alumni, parents, and friends who are joining us today. We'll also have an opportunity to answer questions from you. Some of those questions have already come in, and I've seeded those into the questions I'm posing to Joy and Craig. But if you'd like to ask questions as the session goes along, please use the Q&A button to do that. And we'll have an opportunity to weave those in as we go. Now, obviously, with the number of participants we have on the call today, I won't be able to ask every question, but I'll do my best to ask questions that seem to be representative of what's on most people's minds. Let me say a word about Joy and Craig before I invite Joy on. Joy is a 1981 graduate of BC's Lynch School of Education. She spent her early career in elementary and secondary school education, and just prior to coming to BC, she was the interim head at the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy in Johannesburg, South Africa. I actually first met Joy when she returned from South Africa to the Heights in 2010, when she received an honorary degree from BC. We had a terrific conversation, and at that point, Joy was interested in coming home back to the United States from South Africa. And I and my colleagues in University Advancement had the good fortune of welcoming her into a role in University Advancement, first leading donor relations and later leading alumni relations as our Associate Vice President for Alumni Relations. In 2018, she stepped into an interim role leading student affairs and was named the Vice President last summer. Craig, who joins us in a little while, has degrees from Brown University and his master's and PhD from the Catholic University of America. He joined BC 16 years ago, first as a clinical psychologist, and then 5 years ago was named as interim director and later full director of University Counseling Services. In his role, Craig oversees a staff of 27. A typical year, Craig and his team provide counseling and other forms of support to nearly 2,000 students. That's enough about Craig and Joy for me. Let's invite Joy onto the call and start our conversation up. Joy, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Joy. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Jim. Good to see you. Good to be with you and participants today.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us, Joy. And boy, we had a lot of questions come in advance of our session today. And I could tell just from the number of people who have registered and the questions coming in, you know, people are really eager to hear from you and to hear from Craig. So I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to join us today. Thanks so much.
Sure, happy to do it.
Joy, you know, I said a little bit in terms of the basic bio, but I always think it's helpful for people to hear about a person's role from themselves. I know you well enough to know there's no such thing as a typical week in the life of the Vice President for Student Affairs. But in whatever way you can, would you just give us a sense of, you know, what is, you know, sort of on your docket over any, you know, few weeks during a typical year, of course, pre-COVID? Give us a sense of your role and how you approach it.
Sure, happy to do that. So, you know, it generally starts early in the morning with reading a lot of emails. And I do receive a fair number of emails from students, and I make sure to respond directly back to them, and I like to be able to do it within 24 hours. Now, I know for students, 24 hours seems like a lifetime, so in between that, I usually get another email just checking to see if I got their first email. And so I do respond to all of those emails. And then I typically, you know, have several meetings over the course of the week with staff members, with campus partners, with faculty members, and sometimes with parents. And I guess I would probably say I attend anywhere between two or three events in the evening. And these are student organizations that are having meetings or their student events that I've been invited to say a few words, or it's going to watch a student production or an athletic event. So, I mean, I could virtually be out every night of the week, but right now I try to keep that to around 2 to 3, mm-hmm. sort of the typical day or week.
And Joy, you know, we also have, you have a lot of parents on the call who, of course, you know, parents of our current students know BC well. We have a lot of alumni on the call today, on the webinar today, who, you know, probably many of them haven't visited the Heights in a while. How would you describe BC, and in particular our student body, to people who've not spent time on campus recently? You know, what impressions, you know, would you offer people? What impressions do visitors have of our student body? Can you give me a sense of the flavor of the student body at BC?
Sure. So, I mean, we have a very diverse student body. We have 36% Ohana, and our students come from all across the United States and around the world. And we have a student body that's, I think, about 15% alumni legacy families. And then about 68 or so percent of our students receive some sort of financial aid. And I would say that today's students are clearly very, very bright. They're multi-talented. They're energetic. They're passionate. They're kind. I think they push the envelope from time to time, but it's always in a respectful way. And they're really proud of being a BC student. And I think that they realize that it means more than just, you know, graduating from a place, that they really look to stay connected. And I think they want to sort of leave their legacy while they're getting about to graduate. And I think that they know that there's an expectation that they have to contribute to the world and be good citizens. So the men and women's for others, that continues on very strongly.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't go to BC myself. You were a BC, you're a BC alum. But boy, the thing that struck me about BC when I compare it to other schools I know well is you talked about this Eagles for Others, this idea of being men and women for others, and the commitment to both service and really sense of community. Is that something that's changed over the years, or is that always been there for BC? Does it feel different to you from when you were a student?
Well, you know, I think that it's always been there. I think it manifests itself in different ways over the years. So when I was a student, you know, we certainly understood what that meant. But I think maybe students now take it a step further. And I think their early commitment to wanting to get out and, you know, be men and women for others right, you know, right out of the bat is maybe something that my fellow alums, we didn't quite jump into it that quickly.
Mm-hmm. Joy, we want to spend, I think, most of our time talking about the current environment. Mm-hmm. You know, you're vice president of student affairs with very few students on campus today. Mm-hmm. And obviously we all know what's going on in the world around us. So let's dive in a little bit to, you know, what you're noticing and how all things related to COVID are impacting the world of our students. And let me maybe start with, let's go back 8 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We talked to David Quigley in this forum a couple of weeks ago. David talked a lot about what it was like to try to mobilize the faculty for roles off campus, teaching mm-hmm. remotely and that whole process. You know, your role, you were very much responsible for mobilizing the students for their departure from campus and their effort to stay connected to BC in this remote environment. Can you walk us through that? You know, what was that experience like? What was the process like? What would you share in terms of giving everyone a sense of what was involved and what your takeaways were from that process?
Sure. You know, I think maybe the best way to start out is to give a little anecdote, a little story of how it unfolded when the news first came out. And then I can talk a little bit more sort of what the logistics were right. But I was just starting a dinner meeting with a student organization, the Asian Caucus. And so we had just sort of gotten our food and we're sitting around the table, and it was probably around five or so. And the students, you know, as always, are on their phones. And so then the letter from the president came through, and I looked around the room, and they were, of course, all reading it. And then I noticed that their faces were just in disbelief as they particularly were reading the passage that talked about they would be going home for the rest of the semester. And so emotion was very prevalent and quick, and they some of them started to cry. You know, there was just that sense of loss right away. And so needless to say, you know, we ended the meeting at that point, because I knew that they needed to go and be with their friends, because that was the first thing on their mind, that they were going to be leaving all of their friends much sooner than they had ever expected. You know, I think as the weeks earlier was going back and forth, are we going to close? When are we going to close? All that sort of thing. I think a fair number of students may have thought that we were going to just do remote learning, but they could stay on campus. Mm-hmm. So that they would have their laptops and their mods, and they would be taking their classes remotely in that way. Not that they were actually going to have to go home. So I think there was a bit of shock and you know, just the abruptness, because it all happened quickly. And so then kind of moving to the logistics. So now we have the undertaking of moving, you know, over 7,000 students off campus in 3 days. And so packing and moving young people when they've had a year's notice is challenging, never mind 3 days. So we of course had to inform the parents, and then packing supplies had to be secured and delivered, and we had to provide storage options for students, and all those recycling receptacles stationed around campus, and volunteers, and then just an army of moving professionals to really help get things out of the res and the mods, and they collect a lot of things over the course of their time here, and you know, with no sort of advance notice that they would have to pack, it was definitely challenging. But by Sunday evening at around 8 o'clock, which was our target date, we had all of the students had departed, except for about 400 or so that remained on campus.
Yeah, I want to talk mostly about the students who are off campus, but you mentioned this, so let's touch on this for a few minutes too, because I'm not sure everyone's even aware of that. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, why did some students stay, and anything you want to offer about, you know, what their experience has been, how many are still with us or had been with us right through the end of the semester?
Yeah, sure. So in the announcement message that came out from Father Leahy, he did indicate that any student who had extenuating circumstances could put in a request for the option to stay on campus. So we had more than 600 students who submitted these requests to stay on campus due to extenuating circumstances. And, you know, those entail things like, you know, international travel difficulties, that they may have had an elderly or immune compromised family member at home, that it was maybe an unsafe living situation at home. Some students maybe who have come out as gay, but their parents don't know, or they do know, and the situation at home might be tense. Financial hardships for families. So it was really quite a range of circumstances. And so there was a team of about 6 to 8 of us who reviewed every request, and we actually reviewed them twice, and ended up approving 400 to stay on upper campus. So we moved them, if any of them were on lower campus, to upper campus. And as of today, which is the 12th of May, this is departure day because exams are finished. And so they're all will be leaving campus today. I think over this past week, we probably had about 250 of them who had remained from that original 400.
Okay. That's a quite a commitment and quite a logistical sort of set of issues to go through. Let's turn back now to the students, you know, the vast majority of our students who have been off campus. What have you been hearing, you know, from students and their families since they've been on campus? You know, do you have a sense of how they've been faring outside of their remote classrooms, which is, I know, the primary focus of you and the folks in student affairs?
Right. Well, you know, what I've been hearing is that, you know, for us, supporting the students who returned home took a little bit of time to catch on, and rightfully so, because first and foremost, they needed to get adjusted to their new mode of remote instruction and their new sort of academic routine at home. And so this took, I think it was about a couple of weeks for the majority of students. Now, some have had more of a challenge due to family circumstances or possible mental health issues and just trying to adjust to that change. But for the most part, I think after about a couple of weeks, then we started seeing students wanting to engage more in their student organizations and sort of the social aspects of things.
And so actually that's a, you know, that reminds me of another good question. And this has come in from some folks. What about, you know, student organizations? You know, we're all aware of just how active those organizations are, not just for the students who participate in them, but for students who enjoy the offerings of these groups. You know, has anything been able to replace that? Have there been ways of students staying connected to the activities of their organizations and places, or is it all just on pause?
Yeah, so they have stayed connected. I mean, nothing can replace the in-person physical, you know, engagement that is the hallmark of, you know, a BC experience. I think the student organizations and our other offices within student affairs, like the career services and of course Res Life and the Women's Center and BAIC, have all continued to offer their programming, but they've done it remotely. And so the students have still engaged in that way to try to keep their student organizations moving through. Any of our leadership development programs, those have been continuing on. And, you know, people are starting to prepare for the fall and, you know, what things will look like in the fall for their student organization or their particular department. So it's been ongoing.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of people listening heard that reference to the fall, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. For now, let's stay on the track of supporting students who are at home and how we just support students who are in need, which is, I think, just such a wonderful aspect to the way in which your office does the work that it does. So this might be a good time, Joy, to welcome Craig to join us and we can get into a conversation together. Craig, I think you're in the wings someplace. Need one on. Hi, Craig.
Happy to join you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Good to have you. Craig, where are you joining us from?
I am in our guest room here in Needham, not far away from the Heights. Kids in the background, hopefully keeping quiet, but doing our best.
That's great. Well, I like to say that my reality with a BC junior at home is fighting for bandwidth. So hopefully we won't have any hiccups.
Right, we're lucky to have it.
We are. Craig, you know, I introduced you in terms of your basic background, but maybe just give everyone a sense in your own words of the work that you and your team do, and maybe here again, like Joy did, go back to pre-COVID times. What occupies most of your team's time? What's you and your colleagues, your primary focus in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, the good old days. So our work is primarily about direct service, clinical counseling, mental health services to the student body, both undergraduate and graduate. I think as you'd mentioned, we see nearly 2,000 students in a given year. A rough estimate is that we will see about 45% of all undergraduates at least once in the time that they are here at BC. So pretty heavy clinical load, which is primarily individual therapy, group therapies. We have an extensively utilized emergency clinical service available 24/7 to all students. But as a part of that, we also are available to faculty and staff or parents, friends, for their concerns about students. So there's a lot of consultation that we provide. And that's something that's certainly continued in these past 12 months now. So most of our day really is in that direct one-to-one or group-based contact with students, as well as some consultation, training of other staff or faculty around responding to mental health issues as well.
And Craig, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, and actually one question that came in touches on an interesting item here, which is a person writes that their wife is a teacher, and that person believes that younger people are more psychologically fragile than earlier generations. This is in the questioner's words, and is asking, you know, what has BC, what have you observed in this? Is that something you feel, or do you see it differently than that, if you think about students today to compare to when you first started doing this work or earlier than that?
Yeah, I'm always hesitant to give a full generalization, you know, the sort of the kids these days judgment. I think there is lots of data out there that does point to some generational differences around measures of resilience on a population level. But I would also say that we have some incredibly resilient and some incredibly robust students, those who suffer with mental health issues and those who don't. So I don't want to, you know, paint everybody with a single broad brush. That said, there is certainly a shift in the types of presentations and the number of people that the counseling services works with over the years that I've been there. There's been a significant growth in the numbers of students that we see, which has also necessitated a growth in our staff. There has been a shift from more issues around sort of adjustment and, you know, struggle with some of the academic strains and maybe some depressed mood to a much higher rate of general anxiety issues that we've seen. And, you know, that's something that is worrying, I think, on one degree, and also that we will anticipate will be a real hallmark of the coming years, probably ahead. You know, this is, for many people, a traumatic event in many ways, and people will be dealing with grief in many ways from what is lost and what they've had to adapt to.
Yeah, and Craig, that leads right into another question that a number of folks have asked, which is, you know, how has your work shifted with students on campus? You know, one person asked if you've seen an increase in need, and another person is asking, you know, is this something you can do remotely, and can you do it as effectively remotely as you can do on campus?
Lots of layers to that. So our work certainly has changed. As Joy mentioned, we have had many students. We've been, you know, very fortunate. I've been amazed at the ability of BC to hold as many students as we have on campus and provide a safe haven. But it's clearly a much smaller percentage. And even those who are on campus, we are not sitting with them in the same room. We're meeting over something akin to this, a secure platform that is that it's a safe way to be able to meet with students, whether it's over a telephone or over a video conference connection. There is data out there pointing to telehealth as being essentially as effective as in-person, in the same room counseling for many issues. There are some variations in that. We have seen some decrease in the overall numbers of people that we're interacting with as Obviously, the vast majority of people have gone home and they've had other supports around them, some for the better, some for the worse. And so we've had to adapt in the ways that we respond. We've innovated and come up with a whole series of different group offerings for students, some general broad support groups and some more specified, a specific AHANA identified support group, a specific international support group, also some skills-based groups to help people with mindfulness and meditation and anxiety management skills, things like that.
And, you know, the individual sessions, is that something that is happening and working effectively remotely as well in addition to the group sessions?
We are continuing to see people individually. You know, we believe it's effective. We hope it's effective. you know, I guess the proof will be in the pudding in some ways, how people are doing. We're getting, you know, certainly positive feedback and appreciation about the ability to maintain those contacts. I would say that the one caveat there is that within our fields, the reality is that we are all licensed within an individual state. And so there are then limitations and restrictions about practice across state lines. And there's been a lot of advocacy work done both on state and national levels to expand that access. So we have really, quite frankly, prioritized maintaining contact. And, you know, as I say frequently, I would rather provide a little bit more to somebody and, you know, have to explain why we maybe bent the rule a little bit and be available than turn someone away and have to defend doing that. So we have certainly chosen that as our priority and will continue to, as we look forward, we're thinking about how we can best maintain contacts through the summer and in whatever the fall holds.
I'm turning now more and more to these wonderful questions that are coming in. And there are a number of questions, Craig, for you from the perspective of parents who want to support students who are at home, some of whom have BC students at home, some of people who have, you know, alums who have other students from other schools at home. And one question, I'll just read this one that reads this way. Do you have advice for what we parents can do to help our students who are now home and may appear quite depressed, no longer wanting to get engaged in activities, exercise, engaging in conversations? You know, any advice that you might have for, you know, parents who are trying to do the best they can to support their students through what can be a difficult time?
Yeah. It is a difficult time, right? And I think we all have to acknowledge that. I think for many people, there's a first impulse to appear brave and appear strong and appear that you have it all together, particularly for your kids, right? You know, I know, you know, I've certainly been guilty of doing that. And in many times, that's a really positive impulse. When the reality is that there are significant risks and significant dangers out there, I think it's important that we acknowledge them and acknowledge the real basis of some of that emotion that may well be taking place. You know, I think it's useful to acknowledge it because it then sort of puts it in motion. It allows it to be dealt with in some ways. That means providing, you know, a real empathy, just listening. Quite frankly, is what we hear students saying they really want from their families. Not the first solution, hey, sit down on this desk and here's your Wi-Fi and go to work. It's they want somebody to hear what the problem is without telling them what the solution is for at least a little while. That said, there is a next step, which is helping them think about what some of those helpful tools and skills are. Things like building in routines. You know, I make a point of getting up each morning, and for the most part, I'm taking the dog out on a long walk because it clears my mind. Getting a little bit of exercise makes a big difference. Trying to keep some routine of sleep and wake, right? When we don't have the regular cues of groups that we're meeting with or classes we're going to in person, it can be easy to just stay up into the wee hours of the morning and wake up midday and get really thrown off your schedule. So helping, you know, helping their students maintain those routines and those schedules is really important as well. And then helping them think a little bit about the possible options and the possible outcomes of what comes next, while also recognizing that there is going to be, for many people, a tendency towards what we'll call catastrophic thinking, imagining just the worst case. And I think what parents can do is to help their kids challenge some of those worst case scenarios and to step back from some of the black and white thinking that that's a fairly natural tendency we all have.
Joy and Craig both, but Joy, there are some questions that are coming in that now begin to tilt toward looking ahead, and some also questions that touch on some of the things that you've mentioned. And you know, one person is asking about summer in particular. A number of people are actually asking about summer and just how you're using the summer. You know, are there things that BC can do to stay in touch with students, you know, during the summer months, or anything else you might want to share about summer before we turn our attention to the fall and the year ahead?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, the summer is a busy time for us, actually, because we're getting prepared for the fall. And so we have all the new students who are usually part of our orientation program that starts in June. That'll be virtual this year. But on the student affairs front, you know, we generally spend the summer with our current students who might need assistance with, let's say, career coaching and maybe some interviewing techniques and strategies, working with our student organizations and the leaderships of those student orgs, gearing up for all of the summer, the housing assignments and all the shifting that goes on with that throughout the summer. As I said, you know, we have a number of programs, not only the orientation, but OTE, Options Through Education program that's run by BAIC. So now this summer, you know, we're going to have all the work to be done in preparation with COVID-19 in mind for returning to school in the fall. So there's a lot going on in that space right now.
So Joy, let's now maybe turn to that. And Craig, I'll give you a minute and a bit to come back to summer if you'd like, but I think most questions are about the fall, and we have about a half hour left. I want to be sure we're getting to that. And then if we have time, I'll get to some other non-fall related questions. Joy, just pick up where you left off. How's BC thinking about the fall? I know we haven't made a formal announcement yet, but you know, what can you share with people who are curious about that? And then maybe a little bit about, you know, how you're preparing for the year from the point of view of supporting students in a healthy environment in the year ahead.
Sure. So, you know, looking ahead to the fall, I would say that we are all driving towards that August 31, first day of classes start date. So I think that's a priority for all of the offices on campus that need to prepare and be ready for students to come back if August 31st is the date. There are a number of contingency planning groups right now that are underway and starting to think about every aspect you can imagine as it relates to COVID-19 and physical distancing and testing and keeping everybody as safe as possible. So those groups are meeting and working on various scenarios too. So, you know, what if the medical professionals or our local government says that schools can't open in August? So what's the next plan? What is another date that we could shoot for? And if we're shooting for that date, then how does that alter the plans that we put in place for a regular start time? So we're needing to be able to anticipate what some of the issues complications and complexities are going to be and have a plan for sorting them out. Certainly, we don't have all the answers to all that yet, no place, I think, really does. Everybody's just trying right now to get a sense of what things they might be able to actually manage on their particular campus, and we're doing the same.
Troy, maybe just share a little bit more about, let's assume for the sake of argument that, you know, we're fortunate and we have a path to welcoming students back. You know, mm-hmm. I agree, you know, it's the drive, that's what we're all hoping for. Some of this is mm-hmm. out of control. Two aspects of your world are really impacted by post-COVID return to campus, you know, residential life, you know, the mm-hmm. residence halls and students' organizations, both of which have density attached to them and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. You know, is it too soon for you to offer some thoughts on how you're approaching scenario planning for a world where students come back, but obviously, you know, they may be back on campus well before we have a vaccine?
Well, I can certainly share with you some of the thinking that has been going on in some of our groups. And let me just add another major impact area, and that would be dining services. Mm. The food is a big part of people's lives here on campus, and we have to take into account the changes that would be made there. But, you know, right off the bat, you know, we know that we're going to have smaller gatherings. You know, our residence halls are designed to be community spaces. And so we often like to bring them together as a community in the residence hall. So we're going to have to do that differently. That might need to be done remotely. We learned a lot over the summer having the 400 plus students living on campus. We did mandatory residence hall meetings, you know, remotely. And so students got familiar with what that looked like and felt like, different from gathering together in their lounge and in their residence halls. We know that there are going to be, you know, restrictions on, you know, numbers in the classroom, numbers in study groups. We're going to have to, and have already started looking at, room configurations to make sure that all of the beds are 6 feet apart, you know, trying to adhere to the physical distancing requirements that we suspect are still going to be ongoing. There's going to be lots of more frequent cleaning of the common restrooms and the lounges and common touch points, you know, the door handles and the elevator buttons and all these things that you generally don't think about in that way. We're going to have to now have as part of our routine planning. And, you know, testing, if it's available and if we can get it, I mean, we certainly were able to do that on a small scale this summer when we had students on campus. But I imagine temperature checks are going to be part of our thinking of, you know, each day, checking in on students in that way. Masks when they're out in public areas, gloves. We're going to have to scale back the number of students in the dining halls. And so sort of to de-densify, probably we'll take some tables out and only allow X number of students at each table. And what we did learn, another good lesson from the summer, is that the students enjoy the grab and go from dining. So like takeout, so they were much more preferred going into McElroy, getting their grab and go and going back to their residence hall. So I know that the dining services team is looking at trying to create sort of satellite stations around campus for these grab and go pickups. And I also think they're looking at extending the hours for meal service. So for instance, right now, you know, lunch is served usually from 11 till I think about 2 or 2:30. So now we're looking at, would we start it at 10:30 and go until 3 or 3:30 just to expand that so you don't have that same sort of crowd showing up in there. So a number of things that we're looking at, and we know that there'll be more.
Yeah, it's a lot. And Craig, let's, you know, turn to your world as you think about the summer and counseling services. Do you anticipate an increased need? How are you preparing, you and your team preparing for a possible fall with students back on campus?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Troy pointed out, we're all working on multiple contingencies. We're really hoping for a fall return to campus, and that's plan A, but it would be irresponsible not to think about plan B, C, D, and E, quite frankly. So we're all quite busy with that. For the summer, we are still open and in business, and we are available to students who are taking classes remotely, and we'll still be available for consultation to students even who aren't taking classes. We've maintained that series of support groups I'd mentioned, and those will continue to be available even to students who aren't currently going to be taking classes through the summer. Importantly, you know, as you said, right, a lot of the questions are about the fall and what will happen. I think, as I'd mentioned before, the data really does point to the viability and the efficacy of telehealth as a modality to deliver mental health services. And so we will be continuing to use telehealth as our primary mode of delivering services rather than forcing somebody to come into a small space and sit close together. We'll be providing ongoing individual or group counseling for people who are on campus or those who are remote as well. And we're going to be working with, as I mentioned, some of those licensure issues to make sure we can provide the best available treatment. We have a great group of really creative clinicians who are eager to come up with all kinds of ways to deliver really meaningful and timely services. You know, Joy used a specific term a moment ago, which was physical distancing, which I thought was a really important distinction that I'm starting to hear a little bit more out there in the public, which is really distinguishing from social distancing, which has been a mistaken term for a long time. Social distancing is really connecting to what is kind of an epidemic prior to COVID of loneliness and of isolation. And so we're really working in counseling as well as the whole health and wellness area that includes Office of Health Promotion, Health Services, Women's Center, the Student Outreach and Support Services, as well as a number of other collaborators, you know, in our areas to think about how we can maintain social connection and all of the resilience-inducing capacities that staying connected provide, whether that's in direct clinical services that we'll maintain or other outreach work that we'll be, you know, very busy with. That's going to be continuing, quite frankly, no matter what form the fall takes. Mm-hmm.
Joy, I want to give some time to some really terrific questions are coming. And there are two different people who have asked questions that touch. One touches on rising sophomores and the other touches on our soon to be graduating seniors. I'll start with the sophomore question. This person writes, my freshman son was still figuring out where he fit in with student organizations. Second semester would have been his chance to find more connections. How's BC going to help rising sophomores in the fall who, you know, in many ways, some ways may still feel like freshmen, you know, because they missed that traditional kind of end to the year. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, you know, I think what we will try to do is reel back a little bit to that semester that they really missed and try to engage them in the ways that they would have been engaged in their second semester. Sort of to, I guess, reboot and give them the opportunity to learn more about some of those student organizations that they wouldn't have gotten the chance to learn as much about, and be really intentional about making them available to students so that they know who to outreach to. And so often, you know, that just means a lot more communication so that they're aware that this opportunity is available to them. And I suspect too that we'll have more students who are gonna wanna try out more clubs than maybe they normally would, just because they wanna test it out and see if this is the one and be able to sort of make a quick decision on that. And so I'm sure that we'll give them the leeway to be able to do that. You know, we obviously don't want them to overload, but if they're interested in a number of different organizations and they can test them out, then I think that might be a fair way to sort of balance out what they missed.
Mm-hmm. And then a number of questions about the seniors enjoy. I'm just thinking about the conversation you and I had last week when we were talking about how, you know, the senior class is the one that really just sort of tugs at our heartstrings. But here's here's something I'll read from someone who writes, I'm a BC alum. I know how special the last 2 months of senior year are and how that time set me up for being a highly energized alum. My sister is a graduating senior at BC, so I've seen firsthand how challenging this lost time has been for seniors. How can we, this person terms it as BC itself and fellow alumni, help our newest alums cope with the overwhelming loss they may feel now and also as they move forward? And Jory, you can answer that. And Craig, you may have some thoughts on that from a point of view of coping with loss.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that we are going to need to rely on our alumni to outreach in a deeper way with the first year graduates to bring them into the fold, maybe sooner than we typically do. So for instance, I've heard some discussion on, you know, we traditionally have reunions every fifth year, and so you don't have one until you're 5 years out, but maybe with this class, we make an exception and they can be part of maybe some of the reunion activities that would happen in June of 2021. I think that that's something worth discussing and seeing what the possibilities are there. And, you know, we're, of course, as you know, looking to see what we can do as by way of celebration of the class of 2020 in October. So those plans are still being worked out, but there's no short of commitment from anyone on this campus who wants to be able to celebrate the seniors in the way that they deserve. So a lot of people are putting a lot of time and energy into trying to make sure that we can do that.
And Craig, any thoughts from your perspective on, you know, for people on call who are parents of seniors who I think, you know, we just know, right? They're, I mean, my daughter has so many friends who are seniors and they're experiencing this just in a very different way. What advice do you have just from a caring point of view?
Sure. Yeah, it is, as you, I think, rightly termed it, it's an experience of loss. And there is a process of grieving. Many people are familiar with that concept at this point, the idea of stages of grief. And there is no single progression of stages, and people may bounce back and forth between those stages that include things like denial and shock, anger, some bargaining, some feeling eventually of, you know, sadness and hopefully then acceptance. What's important is thinking about, you know, those parents or close friends talking with people experiencing grief and losses, that we try and meet people essentially and match them where they are, acknowledging, as I mentioned before, the sadness where it lies, rather than forcing them into just accepting it and move on. Sometimes we need to sit in the discomfort. You know, I'm sure many of the attendees may be familiar with Father Keenan, you know, a wonderful leader on campus. He'd talked with the directors in student affairs early this semester before any of this came up. And one of the things he spoke quite a bit about was the idea of accompaniment. And I think that's really been on my mind lately, this idea about being available as a listener more than as a solver in this stage. And I think that's something that parents can really do with those seniors who are experiencing the sense of loss, just as hard as it is, just to hear it. And over time, you know, hopefully they then can move to a state of finding some acceptance and maybe even finding meaning, finding something that they have gained from this experience, you know, as unchosen as it may be, some way to find some meaning and purpose in moving forward.
And Jim, let me add that I think for alumni and parents in particular who are looking for, you know, tangible ways to help. You hopefully many people received my letter about the Eagles to Eagles Fund, and I do think that is a tangible way to contribute financial resources to those students who have been impacted in a particular way due to this pandemic. I mean, many have found themselves in unexpected, you know, financial hardships. And so I know that this fund is directing resources to those students who need it in this time of crisis. So just as a as another tangible way.
Yeah, thanks, Joy. And let me just add my thanks, because so many people on the call have done that and support BC in so many different ways. And I think that person who asked the question about how alumni can help really speaks to the spirit of our alums. You know, as we wrap up in the last 10 minutes or so, you know, a couple people were curious to know, as you look back retrospectively over kind of the past 8 weeks, you know, any anecdotes of things that have been sources of nourishment for yourself, you know, things that you look back on and say, that was a good day, that was a good moment, that was a place where I or someone on my team really stepped in and helped, and I'm going to hold on to that. And, you know, anything where you look back and say, you know, this may be something we missed that we're learning from and growing from, because maybe we didn't get that quite right. It wasn't everything I hoped. And you don't both have to answer both parts of it, but I'm just wondering if you have any way of responding to those kinds of questions.
Mm. Well, I think for me, I guess I sort of see, you know, what were the highs that occurred during this time, and the sort of positive things that come out of it. And I certainly would point to and look at the resilience and the adaptability that the majority of our students had. Not all, but the majority. You know, to use a little baseball analogy, you know, they were really thrown a curveball, but they knocked it out of the park in being able to adapt as quickly as they did, and persevere, and now find themselves, you know, soon ending the year successfully. And that was no easy feat, I think. I think obviously the lows have been seeing those students who have struggled in the remote environment, and wanting to make sure that we can get them back on track when we finally do get back on campus, or at least provide them with the support that they're going to need as they venture out into the world. I also, you know, think of the staff in student affairs, and it's been important for me to keep them engaged and feeling less isolated while they're working from home. And on the faculty front, you know, I just have to applaud and give them a shout out for really how smoothly they transitioned from in-person instruction to complete remote delivery. And many students have commented to me just how impressed they were with how seamless their faculty made the transition for them. So that's definitely a high.
Craig?
I just had to throw that up there in response to Joy's baseball comment, as a college baseball player myself, and anybody missing Boston and Fenway. It's actually the Eagles on Fenway's field many years ago. You know, bean pot and baseball, but moments of levity are important. And
yes.
That's actually a part of my answer. Is one thing that I've been really impressed with is our entire community, both students, colleagues, staff, faculty, working together and finding ways to be accepting and supporting of each other, and allowing little moments of humor to pop through in really difficult times. There have been students I've talked with who, you know, we've been able to laugh together as well as to feel real sadness together. Mm-hmm. And those moments of powerful emotion can be hard, but also really curative. So that's really sort of struck home for me. And you know, I'm hopeful that that's something that we'll be able to continue that momentum as we come into summer and fall ahead. Mm-hmm.
And long, let's, you know, just wrap up with, you know, if we have time, long term, what's your outlook for BC? What's BC going to look like on the other side of this? Joy, do you want to share a thought on that?
Sure. My predictions. So I think long term, actually, that BC will be a stronger community. I think there's going to be a great sense of pride that we carried on in the face of a pandemic, and that we cared for the people that we were entrusted with. And, you know, I think that's going to be a hallmark of a period of time in BC's history.
There's a concept out there in the psychological literature of post-traumatic growth that, you know, is not as commonly talked about, but I think is a really important concept for us to keep in mind. While this is terrible right now, unquestionably, and very difficult for everybody in all of the adjustments that we're having to make, not to mention those who are suffering real loss of livelihood or even lives, there is also an opportunity for people to experience some new internalized sense of meaning and purpose and growth that they take out of this. And so, as Joy said, I think there's a real possibility there that BC and its students and its staff come out stronger on the other end, hopefully, sometime in the future.
And one last question, you know, I always, you know, so many of us are looking to other people for tips on, you know, how are you finding nourishment and self-care and inspiration during a time? And you're both in jobs that, you know, I think, as we know, you know, there's stress attached to your jobs. You have a lot on your plate. How are you taking care of yourself? What do you draw on for perspective, you know, comfort, inspiration at a time like this?
Well, on my end, you know, I try to continue my yoga practice. I do it online now, not the same, but I'm still getting it in. And a little bit of meditation and reflection, just some quiet time to be able to think some things through. And I do sort of appreciate that as sort of one unintended, I guess, outcome of being in a stay-at-home mode. And I think that I try to draw on my optimism and my belief in the common good. And I remind myself daily about the things that I'm grateful for and the good fortune that I have to be part of the BC family. So those things have sustained me thus far.
Yeah, I'd echo many of those. Certainly trying to hold some space for gratitudes, for appreciation of what is, the fact that we're still able to help so many students and still able to be there for each other. You know, the fact that we've got this time together as a family is not always, but usually a nice thing to to add to. And similarly, I'd say, you know, exercise has been critical. Getting out in whatever way I can or exercise inside really makes a big difference for me. And then finally, it's also important to hold a bit of self-compassion, accept our limitations for where they are, right? There are some things that in the best of times we could be doing that maybe we just can't do right now. And it doesn't really serve anybody any good to beat ourselves up too much about what is outside of our control, but rather to focus on what is still in our control and what we can manage.
Well, let me say, and I can say this on behalf of people who are on the call, because we've had so many comments of gratitude to both of you directly. I think people sense the work that you do, how important it is, how much is asked of you, and how fortunate we are at Boston College to have our students in your care and in the care of those people who work with you. So let me say thank you, Joy, Craig, for being with us. Thank you to all of you out there who participated in the webinar today. I hope you'll be back with us for our coming webinars. And to all of you, take care of yourselves. Please stay safe, and please stay connected to Boston College. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thanks, Jim.